In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about something about the lives of gay men and women of the Victorian era in Britain and also in the United States. And our guest for the show is Graham Robb. He's authored a newly published book on the subject, which is titled Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century. It's published by W.W. Norton. In the book, he says that while it is true that at this time homosexuality was greatly misunderstood, he also says that there was a surprising attitude of tolerance toward gay culture. This book explores a number of themes, how people discovered their sexuality, whether they tried to disguise it or accepted it. He says it was quite rare for people to be out publicly at the time. However, he says also that Victorian society was fascinated with gay men and women and that had this idea that perhaps somehow they were better equipped for living in the modern world. All of this can be found in the book. If you're interested, you can head out to the bookstore. Our guest, Graham Robb, was born in Manchester, England, and has published widely in French literature and history. He's authored biographies of several French writers, including Baudelaire, Balzac, and Victor Hugo. He makes his home in Oxford and is talking with us this morning by telephone. And as questions occur to you, you're certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask of people is that they're brief. And we ask that so that we can keep the program moving and getting as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone is welcome to call. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Graham Robb, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking.
One question I'd like to start with, and it may for some people be a bit of an obscure point, but I'm interested in having you discuss it, and it's this. Well, first of all, I guess that we have every reason to believe that there have always been some individuals who were sexually attracted to their own gender. The term homosexual, however, is relatively recent. It seems to have been coined maybe around the middle of the 19th century. And so people identifying that themselves that way, at least using that word, that's going to be relatively recent. And I guess that some people actually have made the argument, and some people might find this a little odd, but have made the argument that, in fact, homosexuality as we think of it now didn't really exist before the middle of the 19th century. And the indicator of that fact is the fact that before then, there wasn't a word for it. How does one think about that and what the word means and what identifying as gay means?
Well, there were words that were applied to gay men and women, with most of which we don't use anymore. So, for example, a Marjorie or a Puff or a Molly would be a gay man. Mm-hmm. Lesbian women were often called Sapphis or Tribades. The word homosexual was something new because it implied the existence of heterosexuals. And so until then, it was easier to think that everyone is normal except a few people who happen to be Marjories or Mollies. But after that, or once the word was generally accepted, which wasn't until the 20th century, it was much harder to say, I'm normal and you're not. It was just, you had a different form of sexuality. You know, you were a heterosexual, someone else was homosexual. So that was a word invented by a gay man who thought that gay people should have the same rights and the same social acceptance as straight people.
Hmm. Something that that seems not to have changed from that time to this, although perhaps what we're talking about is a matter of degree, is the level of discomfort that people had with the very notion of homosexuality. And I guess I'm interested in, as you start your book, talking about how it is that as you undertook the research for Strangers, how it is people reacted to the project. It seemed that you got a lot of feedback from people who essentially thought that it was just, you know, it was a story better left untold.
Yeah, that's right. There was no lack of feedback. That's true, and it's very interesting to work on a historical subject and to find the subject of your history still alive and flourishing in the 21st century. And I think that there have been enormous changes, of course, in attitudes or at least behavior towards gay men and women. But once you probe a little deeper, it looks as though a lot of the beliefs and strange theories about homosexuality and where it comes from haven't changed at all.
Hmm. But do you think that I think that it's probably correct to say that homosexuality was always stigmatized, but do you think that it would be correct to say that now in our time, in our place, that the level of stigma is actually greater than it would have been in the time that here we're talking about, in the 1800s?
I think in some senses it certainly is, because nowadays we tend to interpret daily experience in a much wider context. We think about things we've heard on the media, ideas we've picked up from somewhere else. So when we look at an individual, we don't just look at that individual in their immediate social setting. We can also think about grander schemes and statistics and the way society is going and so on. And so on the one hand, that can produce more tolerance, or it can produce a desire for legal reform. On the other hand, it also makes it easier to discriminate, even if it's in a positive way, and say these people are different and they can be assigned to a certain section of the population. You can say that 4% of adult men and women are gay, or whichever statistic you choose. So I think that prejudices are still there, and they always find a way of expressing themselves.
I think perhaps some people might make the argument that the reason that there is so much controversy today about homosexuality is that gay men and women are more visible, they're more out, and that perhaps the reason that at this time that we're talking about in Strangers, we deal with in Strangers, the 1800s, that perhaps the reason that there might have been somewhat less controversy was that it was hidden. It was more concealed. That is, gay men and women were not really out. And I guess that may be an incorrect assumption. So that leads to the question, well, just what level of visibility would there have been in the 1800s for gay men and women?
Well, I think they were more visible than we think they were, partly because of changing customs to do with literature. It was much harder to express certain social realities. And until quite recently, novels, for example, weren't really supposed to express absolutely every aspect of a society. There was a more or less tacit convention that only certain subjects are fit for literature. So our view of the past does tend to be distorted by what's missing from the record. And actually, once you look at private diaries and unpublished accounts of life in the 19th century, both in Europe and the United States, it looks as though people were aware that there was such a thing as homosexuality, even though they didn't call it homosexuality. And certainly people who lived in big cities knew that there was such a thing. And something I found while working on the book is that people do have a tendency to confuse their own personal history with the history of their society. And so people say, no, we never used to talk about homosexuality, we never used to know it existed. Mm. And that's probably true. When you're a child, you don't, until a certain age, know that such things exist. But just because they weren't talked about doesn't mean that they weren't visible.
Is it the title intended to suggest that gay men and women would have been strangers to their straight fellow citizens, or that they were in some way strangers to each other?
Yes, both things. Mm. It was it wasn't just that they were considered strange people. Mm. It was also that it was very difficult to make contact with like-minded people. So they were also strangers to each other, and also strangers themselves, because I think even now the hardest thing about coming out is not making a public declaration of your sexuality, but first of all coming out to yourself and accepting the fact that you are gay. You know, that's the biggest hurdle to overcome in a way.
Our guest is Graham Robb. He's published widely in French literature and history, has written biographies, well-regarded biographies of a number of well-known French authors. He's the author of a newly published book, which is rather different in its focus. It's titled Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century, and it is about the lives of gay men and women in the 1800s, in both in Europe and Britain and America. Norton is the publisher. It's just out. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The first section of the book takes a look at the experiences of gay men and women and what's their experiences were with the legal system and the medical profession. And I suppose if people do have any conceptions about what the experiences were for homosexuals at this time, it would be that they were a persecuted minority, although I don't know that you could come up with anybody other than Oscar Wilde as an example. One of the things that you argue in the book is, in fact, that is a misperception, that while it is true that at the time that homosexual activity was illegal, there were laws on the book saying that it was prohibited, that these laws were not often enforced.
Yeah, that's right. They were Britain was an exception, really, because they had the death penalty for sodomy, which remained in force until 1861, although the last execution of a sodomite was 1835. And there was persecution. I mean, even countries that didn't have laws against homosexuality, because no country had a law against being homosexual, they still found ways of prosecuting men who made love to other men. But it's difficult looking back, because if you just look at one section of the population to see how it was treated, it does look as though they were persecuted, but it's important to remember that for much of the 19th century, in Britain, for example, you could be hanged for minor theft. So it's really, you can't say they weren't persecuted, but there wasn't a deliberate singling out of gay men for persecution. And the main point that came out of that part of the book was really how much worse things were in the 20th century. And that whatever we think about the Victorian period, it was far, far worse in the 20th century, especially from the 1950s. And that also applies to the United States. And you look at convictions for, it was usually indecency. They shoot up and increase several 100%. So in the 19th century, you don't have that massive state interference in the lives of individuals that you get in the 20th century.
Hmm. When you look at attitudes and experiences of gay men and women, and maybe draw some comparisons between what the experience would have been in Britain and in France and in the United States, so in Britain on the continent and in America, were there great differences?
There were differences, certainly. France, for example, decriminalized homosexual behavior after the revolution, and that legal reform was incorporated into the law books of several other countries that came under the dominion of Napoleon Bonaparte. But I think that one of the most striking things is how many similarities there are between the lives of gay men and women in different countries. And one thing that strikes one in particular is how easy it was for gay people, assuming they had enough money, of course, to travel to other countries and to go to certain parts of big cities. And if they knew what to look for, to meet other people like themselves. There was a very international and lively gay culture long before the 20th century, and that you find that in the United States as well as in Europe.
Mm. And that would have been true, obviously there are some class dimensions to this. It would be the kind of thing maybe not everybody would have been able to participate in, but it would have been clear if you knew that there would be certain places, certain sections of certain cities where if you wanted to go and meet somebody else, you would know that would be the place to go.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the problems for gay men and to a lesser extent women was that if you'd escape a small provincial town or village and you were looking for anonymity and friendship, where would you go when you got to a big city? Well, you'd go to places where male prostitutes or lesbian prostitutes were, and which could be a dangerous thing to do because obviously the police kept an eye on those areas. And that's partly why there was this equation of homosexuality with promiscuity or depravity or sin, that those are the places where you were most likely to meet people like yourself. And even though once you were part of that network, you could also find out about other places where you could safely meet like-minded people. There were clubs, societies, musical groups, correspondence networks, which extended all the way through Europe and the United States.
Hmm. Another thing that sort of major theme in this section, we talked a little bit about the legal system and how it thought about homosexuality that you deal with in this part of the book is the way that the medical profession thought about homosexuality and the fact that there was the widespread belief that that it was an illness and that it was something that could be cured, and that an awful lot of things, not particularly pleasant or humane things, were done to men and women in the attempt, perhaps well-intentioned but ultimately misguided, to fix them.
Yeah, that's right. It's absolutely right to say it was often well-intentioned because the doctors who took an interest in homosexuality as a pathological condition or some strange illness for which they would find a cure were, on the whole, taking serious risks. You know, it wasn't the sort of thing on which you could easily build a career, and most people preferred not to think about it at all. But the problem with that is that once it was identified as an illness, although it meant that there could be more humane treatment of gay people, of course it meant that they were trying to cure them of something that wasn't an illness. It was a disease that was actually a form of health. there were a few doctors who made this startling discovery that actually it was possible to be gay and mentally healthy at the same time. But unfortunately, far more doctors got very enthusiastic about developing cures, and some of them thought that they'd even achieved a degree of success by hypnotizing people or using aversion therapy or electrical treatment and even later on castration. So it was it's something which is still going on today, actually, that, even though it's no longer recognized as an illness. There are psychiatrists who will claim to treat what they call pre-homosexual children. So it's been that's, again, something that really got going in the 20th century that was took a very, very mild form in the 19th century.
Hmm. Well, here we're talking about a time when the medical profession and medical thinking was not where it is today, and also here this really would also be the early years of modern psychology. So I guess I'm wondering, as people thought about why it was that a person would be attracted sexually to their own gender, how did they think about what was going on and what it was that led someone to be homosexual?
Well, that's exactly it. The whole problem was that they were looking for a cause. Of course, once you're looking for a cause, you can look at any effect or any attribute of it and say, aha, that must be what causes it. So Freud, for example, probably came up with the most convincing theory, and one that's still heard today, and that is that homosexual men are produced by weak or absent fathers and domineering mothers. And this actually was just describing something that happened very commonly in families. If they realized that the son was gay, that fathers tended to sever all ties, and mothers tended to overcompensate and be sympathetic. So that, you know, that's the sort of idea that seems very convincing because it's almost indestructibly elastic. You can, you know, even if the father's sympathetic, you can still say he's a weak father. And there's really no end to it. I think that Freud himself eventually decided that looking for the cause of something which occurred quite naturally in a certain percentage of the population was a waste of time, that it wasn't professionally interesting. And so much later, about 30 years after he developed that theory, when an American woman wrote to him saying that she was worried about her son, who was homosexual, Freud said, it's not a disease, it's not an aberration, it's not a perversion. The only problem with it is that society discriminates against homosexuals, and that's what makes them unhappy, not this supposed pathological condition.
We're at our midpoint here, and again, I'd like to introduce our guest, Graham Robb. He has published widely in both French literature and history and is the author of well-regarded biographies of the French writers Baudelaire, Balzac, Victor Hugo. He is author of a new book that explores a different kind of territory. It's titled Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century, and it's published by W.W. Norton. It is in bookstores now if you want to look at it. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that gay men and women at that time faced, in wrestling with the stigma, faced the same kind of conditions that gay men and women face now, and that is how, if you live in a culture that says there's something wrong with you, how can you come to the conclusion that there's not? At this time, if you take a look at what record there is, and it would have been people writing, I'm sure, about their own experiences and their own lives, how people who were homosexual thought about themselves and what level of comfort and acceptance of themselves did they have?
Yeah, it obviously varied a tremendous amount from one individual to the next, but a lot of people who discovered that they were homosexual assumed at first that no one else was like them anywhere, and that this was a terrible thing that had just happened to them. And then other people were perfectly happy once they realized they were homosexual and didn't see anything wrong with it. I think the general impression one has is that it was a lot easier to be homosexual in the 19th century because you weren't forced to see yourself in such a wide picture, and you didn't have to read prejudiced accounts of homosexuality. So there again, it was in some ways a much happier time than it was in the mid-20th century. It's very difficult to generalize, and it's partly because people who led fulfilling, happy, gay lives, like Walt Whitman, for example, would deny everything whenever anyone tried to get the truth out of them. There was a British writer, Simmons, who kept sending letters to Walt Whitman because he was writing a book about gay love, and he wanted an unequivocal statement from Whitman. And Whitman wrote back saying, this seems damnable to me, and I'm shocked that my poems, The Leaves of Grass, could be read in such a way. And of course he said that. I mean, it would be things would have gone very badly for him if the letter had been made public and it had a positive statement about it. And yet, Whitman's poems and his diaries speak for themselves and certainly don't give any impression of an attempt to delude himself or of unusual misery at all.
We have a caller, and would certainly other people who are listening or who want to call in, ask questions, can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, but anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Caller here is on our toll-free line calling from Marshall, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You made a statement earlier that Freud had concluded ultimately that that homosexuality was kind of a natural phenomena. Is there a difference between different parts of the world as to, like Africa or Asia, as to the number of, the percentage of people that have that are homosexual? Does it vary greatly from one society to another? If you can answer that or tackle that, thank you. I'm going to hang up and listen to your answer. Thank you.
Okay. I'm not sure that anybody really knows that the answer to that question, do you?
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's one of the great unknowns about gay history, because how do you find out what proportion of the population is gay? And to the question that you would ask would be different in every culture. One thing that strikes one is that when people looked at other cultures, they often did say there are far more homosexuals in Italy, for example, than there are in Britain or the US. And in the 19th century, sometimes there were some American newspapers that would say this increase in homosexuality, which we've been seeing in recent years, has come to us from Europe. There was a New York journal called The Whip, which said, fortunately, all these people are English or French. None of them are American as yet. So, that's a kind of trivial perception, but it does seem to reflect differences in different cultures. And even now, some people who go to North Africa think, because of the way men behave with each other, that homosexuality is more common over there. And there has been this perception for a long time that there were more gay men in North Africa. Meanwhile, in North Africa, gay men had the impression, North Africans had the impression that homosexuality had come to them from Europe. So it's very difficult to know. But in the Western world, at least, the statistics generally match up.
Next caller here, Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hi, you just made a point that I was going to make. We lived for about 8 months in Nepal several years ago, and there heterosexual couples do not show signs of physical affection. You don't walk down the street holding hands. You don't kiss in public. You don't hug. But men do all the time, and it wasn't unusual to see police officers sitting in each other's laps, male police officers, men walking down the street holding hands, men walking down the street with their arms around each other. Interestingly, our Nepali instructor, a Nepali man, said, "Now, I know that when Westerners come to Nepal, they think there's a lot of homosexuality here, but we don't have any homosexuals." I had to laugh. But I think that in a culture like that, it may be that it's easier to conceal because of the interactions between men that are sanctioned. And in a culture like that where you need to produce a son so that your son can perform funeral rituals, there's additional pressure to produce a child. And also marriages are arranged. It's pretty difficult to resist those kinds of pressures in that kind of a society. And I asked friends that I got to know who had been living in Nepal for some time, and I said, what's the deal with homosexuality here? And they said, well, it's really tough for gays because there isn't a social scene, and it's really highly frowned on. And then I had another experience. I went a couple of years ago. We were in India, and I was getting off a train and following our group. We were going to a conference, and I was kind of the last person. I stopped to take a picture of two cows standing right in front of a fruit stall, looking like they were customers. And they were on the train, where the passengers get off. They were where you expect people to be, not cows. And as I was walking over the overpass, some women came walking toward me, and one of them said it in a very deep voice. He greeted me, and I forget whether it was in any English or what it was in, but and he clearly wanted to startle me. I was a bit startled, but I was already past him, and I didn't know quite what to say. So I commented on it to our Indian hosts, and they said, well, it's actually considered good luck to have at least transvestites around, and they are often invited to particular ceremonies like weddings and so forth. So in some cultures, there is a social function for people who are not part of the sexually exhibiting majority. I don't like what the heterosexual majority. And I think that that's supposed to be true of some North American Indian cultures as well, but I couldn't speak to that. Thanks a bunch.
All right, thank you. I don't know, Mr. Rob, you want to comment on any of that?
Those are lovely examples. And it's true that North American Indian cultures did also have transvestite figures who were ridiculed and made fun of, but who were also respected and who were thought to be able to see into the future and had special powers. And you could say that we have the same thing in our culture. It tends to be in the media, and you have very obviously camp performers who are admired and enjoyed precisely because they're so flagrant.
As I'm sure you know, here in the United States, right at the moment, we are having a lot of controversy and debate over the subject of gay marriage.
Yeah.
And something that I think we should expect only to grow, and some people think might end up being a big issue in this year's race for the presidency. And, of course, I think some people would point out that it's really not quite so much about gay marriage as it is more broadly about how people feel about homosexuality. I think in this argument, sometimes people who, on the one hand, people who believe that homosexuality is wrong, try to make an argument that says, well, you know, if you look over time and culture, that generally speaking, it has been a taboo activity, that homosexuality has been regarded as being, homosexuals have been thought of as being flawed, and homosexuality has been regarded as a morally wrong activity. On the other hand, people who have a different sort of attitude or more tolerant to homosexuality say something like, well, no, that's not true, that there are places and times at which homosexuality has been stigmatized, but that there are other cultures in which it was accepted or people said, well, you know, it's no big deal, how people express themselves sexually. And so that makes me wonder, well, is it really possible to make any kind of a sweeping generalization about how it is that over time people have thought about homosexuality?
It's possible to make a generalization, but I'm not sure how useful it would be. I think it has in probably most societies that I know about been stigmatized, and it does look as though most societies need to have a group that can be stigmatized in order to survive. But then our society is very unusual, and democracy is also a very unusual thing historically, and it too has been regarded as morally wrong. I think, the way I understand it, this argument really has a practical aspect to it, since it's about the institution of marriage. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly nothing new. There have been gay marriages in many other cultures, including Christian cultures. And certainly in the period I know most about, 19th century, there were ministers who performed gay marriages, both for women and for men. So it isn't something completely new.
Other callers here in Belgium next, in our nearby community here near Danville on line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. You did touch on the topic I was going to talk on with this most recent statement you just made, but the question I have is, how can you frame it? It's against the law for us to discriminate against any individual, including homosexuals or race or whatever. how can it then be made into a constitutional act by this Republican ringmaster we got in D.C. that we can't allow them to have the rights that everybody else has? And where is really the problem other than just the word? Because civil ceremonies seem to be okay with this gentleman we have in the White House.
Well, I don't know to what extent, Mr. Robb, you follow American politics, or you want to comment on that?
I've been following this because there have been similar debates recently in Britain.
Hmm.
But it's true that, you know, when you look at the marriage statistics, I mean, I think, well, what is the rate of divorce in the U.S.? About 58%.
It's quite high, well over half.
Yeah, it's well over half. And at the current rate of change, there'll be more stable gay marriages than straight. I mean, gay people are increasingly monogamous, and straight people are increasingly not. So I think I think there's a real danger when you have a politician who is wanting to exclude from society people who actively want to affirm their place in society, since marriage isn't just a question of two individuals. It's also a social statement. It's a way of belonging to that society. So it's, I agree, I think it's a shame to see President Bush behaving as a dangerous subversive.
Well, it seems to me it's more of a political thing. He wants to keep his righteous right on his side and not let it wander off from him. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good. Let's go to next caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Hello.
Hi. About whether homosexuality is pathological or not, we should remember that homosexuality was declared non-pathological not as a result of any research, but as a result of the homosexuals' political demonstration at the American Psychological Association Convention in 1973. And Dr. Robert Spitzer, who was a respected psychiatric researcher from Columbia University, it was Dr. Spitzer, who was the psychiatrist who actually drafted the justification for declassifying homosexuality as a mental disorder. However, in a later convention, more recently, I think the convention of year 2000, Dr. Spitzer was approached by a group of former homosexuals who had suffered from the pathology of homosexuality and had been cured. And they proposed to him, they convinced him, he found the research that he did suggested by these reformed homosexuals. He found it so interesting that he proposed that the American Psychological Association schedule a symposium on the topic at the 2000 convention. He arranged for speakers. He received approval from the program committee and agreed to moderate the debate. Well, gay activists immediately inside the AP recoiled. They wouldn't even allow the subject to be discussed. And by the way, they did succeed in canceling it. And however, there was a workshop. Is homophobia a mental disorder? Is homophobia a mental disorder? That proceeded without opposition, but they would not allow a discussion of whether homosexuality was a pathological. But in any case, there are a number of people who have greatly benefited from homosexual reparative therapy, and the data is clear, and you can't deny them.
Well, I don't know, Mr. Robb, is that anything that you have some thoughts about?
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, the data is clear. When you look at the history of the medical profession in its dealings with gay men and women, the most striking thing is the appalling amount of misery that they caused by considering it something that fell within their jurisdiction. Of course, the best-known example of that was the policy of the Nazi Party, which was responsible for the deaths of thousands of homosexuals in death camps. And the incarceration of those people was a direct result of medical theories, which were propounded in many cases by German doctors or German-speaking doctors.
Now, if the data is so clear, you would think that the gay activists inside the American Psychological Association would want this clear evidence discussed. Let's have a symposium and discuss the clear evidence that there is no pathology in homosexuality. Wouldn't you think that? Wouldn't they want it discussed? Wouldn't they want it openly publicized?
But you see, as soon as you discuss things on those terms, you're admitting that there is something unnatural or there's something pathological. You know, what would you expect black people to enter a discussion of comparative racial attributes or inferiority and superiority? Of course not, because as soon as you enter that kind of debate, you're trapped within its terms. And I think that the people you call gay activists know where progress is likely to lie, and it isn't in getting involved in yet more tail-chasing, ill-informed arguments about what is clearly a natural attribute of the human race. And it's very sad to see a regressive backward tendency in the psychiatric profession, especially in the United States, but also among some religious groups, which you can only think is the result of cynicism or ignorance.
We just have about 5 or 6 minutes left. I'm sure the caller would like to continue, but I have one more caller I'd like to at least try to get in, and we'll do that line number one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments. I agree with the previous caller that the issue is, well, this is clearly a very controversial and will be difficult to solve, and everybody has their own opinion. But the problem is that the gay activists not only want acceptance, but they actually want to push their own agenda. And that's the issue, is that you have to make a stand. Otherwise, these people are going to keep going on and on until there is no end, and the heterosexual will be the unusual or the abnormal circumstance. And so that's not a problem. That's my problem. And then the comment that he made earlier, the speaker about the invited guest about the degree of the fidelity of the homosexual couple versus the infidelity or the divorce rate. I would say that two wrongs don't make a right. The fact that we have a high level of divorce doesn't justify accepting gay or lesbian. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Well, again, Mr. Robb, I don't know, you want to comment on any of that?
Well, that's really just opinion, and I'm interested in historical fact, but people, that is
sure.
A very common view and has been for a very long time.
Let me ask you something, whenever I set out to interview someone, an author, one of the things I like to do is I like to read reviews and interested in what other people think about the book. And one reviewer who in his review identified himself as gay, in a sense outed you in reverse by noting the fact that you were not. And I guess that some people might make the assumption that somebody who would write a book like this probably was. In his review sort of raised this issue, was essentially the issue, well, does that matter? And it's the same question that you might say, well, can a man write a book on women's studies? Could a white person write a book about African Americans?
Sure.
And can a straight person write a book about gay life? I guess I'm interested in what led you to get into this research in the first place, and how you think about this whole issue of, does it really matter, or should it matter that you're not gay and that you're writing about the experiences of people who were?
I think it would be silly to say it doesn't make a difference. I think one big advantage I found was that people were quite prepared to offer their views and theories about homosexuality. It struck me that all the time I was working on 19th century writers, no one ever said, but you were never alive in the 19th century, and you probably only knew two or three people who were even born in the 19th century. So it was really that I had found a lot of information about the gay past, which friends with an interest in gay history didn't seem to know about. So that's really why I wanted to write about it. And then all the more, since I found the prevalence of this idea that homosexuality didn't really exist to the same extent in the past. Mm. So I was really writing as a social historian.
Well, let me raise one other issue that a lot of reviewers have pointed to, and not as a kind of a criticism, or at least as a point worth thinking about, and that and it comes from the fact that the kind of evidence that you would have to rely on, particularly things like people who left a written record of their life experience, and many of the people that we're talking about are all members of a particular class,
yep.
And that it's very difficult to say anything about what for people of the lower social classes, working class people, what their experience would have been. Now, maybe again, you just have to say, well, there's really no way to get at that because we don't have the same kind of record. And I guess I just wonder what you think about the notion that this is, in a sense, a snapshot, but it's only a snapshot of one sort of small and discrete group of people.
Yeah, that's true. It's something I wanted to make clear right at the beginning of the book, that that most of the evidence is from the middle classes and the upper classes, although because of their lives as gay people, they did often have more intimate contact with the working classes or the proletariat than was usually the case. But I think that there is that problem in all forms of social history once you go back into the 19th century and beyond. So it is a problem. There is a lot of information that's lost and that we'll probably never know about. But, you know, you can... It's important to show what evidence there is. I think it's also important, as you say, to say that it is a snapshot, mm-hmm. and not to draw general conclusions, just as we shouldn't draw general conclusions about homosexuality from one or two individuals.
One thing I'm interested in having you talk about, and I just kind of touched on it very briefly right at the beginning when I was introducing the idea, is that the notion that at the time that we're talking about here, that people... Maybe some people had this idea that that gay men and women were somehow better equipped for living in the modern world, and I find that very interesting, and wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, in some ways, because of their involvement with a subculture, with a kind of life that had to remain hidden, they tended to. At least those who lived in big cities, tended to have a much more intimate knowledge of different parts of those cities and different social classes. And they also tended to lead quite international lives, even if they were working class. They were more cosmopolitan on the whole than heterosexual people. And someone once called gay people the first Europeans. You could call them the first internationalists. So in some sense, they were living a kind of life that wasn't that common in the 19th century, which was much more a time of villages and more enclosed units. So that was the point I was trying to make, but it was referring specifically to gay detectives and the way that theme comes up again and again in the myth of the private eye.
Hmm. So do you think Sherlock Holmes was gay?
Well, he was a fictional character, so but Conan Doyle himself was very interested in homosexuality as a doctor, but also as a non-professional person. And there's a lot of Oscar Wilde in Sherlock Holmes. Mm. Conan Doyle admired Wilde greatly. And as the stories go on, he did have a nice sense of humor. There are all sorts of little hints that Conan Doyle threw in, knowing that most of his readers wouldn't notice them or wouldn't interpret them in that way. But the theme's definitely there, yes.
Well, I'm sorry to say that we're going to have to stop. And here, with a whole territory of the impact of gay men and women on culture left untapped, we'll just have to tell people, if you're interested in reading more on this, you should look for the book that we mentioned. It's titled Strangers, Homosexual Love in the 19th Century, published by Norton, by our guest Graham Robb. And Mr. Robb, thank you very much for talking
to us. Thank you very much. Pleasure.